Hey, this is Huck. Subscribe to Thorin's YouTube channel.
Right, I'm here for another episode of Reflections, and this one is going to be with Kalaris, who I hope I said that actually the way he told me about 10 seconds before we started. Obviously, by the way, let's just actually start there. If you ever go back, right, I always tell people, I'm pretty good at it, coming up with like names for shows and stuff, and I have like a little set of protocols, almost a bit like SEO tips of like, you should always be able to spell it, you know, if you say it phonetically, it should be like something that if you Google it's unique, blah, 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 right? When you look back now, would you pick a different alias? Would you phrase it differently? What would you do? Because you do have a name where like, but it's even as I'm reading it now, my brain's like, how do I say, I'm like thinking of like all the different versions I could say. Would you change the branding essentially?
Yes.
Fair enough.
Absolutely. Like, I mean, everyone's like, oh, it's cool. It's kind of a fantasy name, yeah, and things like that. And my brain thought, yeah, okay, I'll kind of combine a few things from things I like and maybe it'll work out. And it is a bit unique, but I'd probably just default back to my childhood nickname, which is literally just Kaz, C-A-Z-Z. Oh, right. That's it.
Okay.
Because James Carroll, that's kind of how it worked.
Kaz, that would work. Know?
Yeah, it'd have been all right. It's much easier for branding, I'll tell you that much, if it had gone that way. So,
okay, so here's where I thought we'd start. Obviously, you are a veteran StarCraft commentator, also did PUBG and other games. By the way, spoiler, anyone who's worked in the ESL has done other games. That's basically ESL's businesses to white label other games. Here's where I want to start with you, though, which is when I did some research, right? One of the things I was going to ask was, and a detail a lot of people miss about people who work in talent is, actually, talent isn't where the person's like a player, like a 17-year-old who's just brilliant at it. Most talent tend to be actually like 10 years older or so. They tend to be in their mid-20s onwards when they get into the industry. And so I've always wondered, actually, how do people make the leap from being nobody to being in the industry? Now, in your case, people maybe know, like you were working with ESL and living in Germany quite early on, and you were like one of the earlier grade of StarCraft people. But I saw in that really old school interview you did back when Hotbed used to do those interviews, which were almost not at all about esports. They were just sort of like, let's talk about everything wacky except esports. In doing so, there was this weird origin story where before you were working in esports, you were living in Germany, you lived in Finland for a few years because you had like a long like a relationship with a girl or something. So what I want to ask was this, as a way to ask, how did you get to Germany, how did you start the StarCraft stuff, I would actually just ask this, which is, what was your experience living in Finland like, and did that sort of give you some sense like, I can live abroad and I can go for an adventure or something? Was there some sort of an origin point like that?
So originally my parents wanted to send me to Australia. Like I was a prisoner
I know, like what?
But I was kind of milling about in England. I didn't really have much direction as to what I wanted to do.
Do you have family in Australia or something?
I actually do, yeah. Right. But I don't think that was the initial reason. Okay. They were just like, oh, well, you could go there for 6 months, find a job, work your way back. I'm like, that sounds awful. So I met this girl online on World of Warcraft, moved out. I'm going to give you the real TLDR.
Yeah, go for it.
Moved out to Finland after meeting her through World of Warcraft, and I just, at that point, I loved living in Finland. Actually, it was very, very nice. We were living on no money at all. I'm talking like a can of Monster Energy was like a luxury for a week, right? Like, so I would stay up and like watch an MLG or something like that with a can of Monster, and I'd be so happy. But it was lovely living in Finland. And I always said eventually that I would retire there. That, things have changed since, because Poland is so nice now and the way it is living here. But it was... How do I describe it? It was kind of almost jarring, kind of going from the UK way of life and things like that. Because I think in the UK, a lot of people are taught the idea of like, oh, look, we've got the best quality of life and everything like that. And I went to Finland and I was like, this is so much nicer and calmer and more peaceful. And there's lakes everywhere and I can just go out in the summer and do all this stuff. So yeah, it was a very nice quality of life in Finland. Is that what you were getting at?
I mean, I would just ask this, like, one of the reasons I bring it up is, as someone who myself has lived different places in the world, one thing I actually found is a bit unique to me, and I wonder about some esports people, is a lot of people do naturally get homesick or something's a bit off about the culture clash, whereas I've personally never found that. Like, I actually found when I lived in places like Korea, I've actually even lived in Finland for a few months myself, I'm not the kind of person who gets sort of like wistful for the old, I sort of just vibe with what I'm into now. Did living there sort of show you could be someone who didn't have to stay at home? Did that give you a sense, like, when the job came to go to Germany, were you up for it? Were you just like all in?
Yeah, as soon as I had left England, I realized that, yeah, I could be quite nomadic, I guess, in that sense. At the same time, I'm not really like a I miss home kind of person as well.
Okay.
Like, I love my parents to death, but I'm I don't really like talk to them that much, right? I don't really talk to my family that much. The only person that I really talk to a lot from England now is either like school friends or my brother, who I'm super close with. We play video games together every single day, basically, if I'm at home and just kind of, you know, doing the usual things. So that's the only real thing. I think the only thing that would take me back to England is if like parents were very ill or something like that.
Sure.
Yeah. And that's it, really.
By the way, when you say that as well, that also somewhat dates you, because in the modern day, maybe it wouldn't even be that weird to meet people in games. But back in the day, that even sounds like the beginning of like a weird anecdote. Like, so anyway, I met her in World of Warcraft, then I moved to Finland. It's like, bloody hell, where does this go? Apparently it was okay. It was all fine. But like, give me some sense. Like, if people don't know Kalaris, so I always sort of think that's an interesting detail, because that is who esports people were back then. We were sort of a bit strange, nerdy people who were living an alternate lifestyle sort of in a way, right?
Yeah. I mean, the idea of meeting people on the internet back then was almost frowned upon,
yes.
Right? Like, if you think about it then, I mean, like, if you think about, like, how you were using MySpace and things like that, and you'd have your top 8 ranked and people, you would meet sometimes random strangers who just kind of lived maybe 15 kilometers away from you in England, and then you meet them through MySpace, and then you would go and meet them, and people would think that that is strange.
Yep.
Never mind the idea of somebody meeting somebody on World of Warcraft and then suddenly meeting up 2 weeks later for a coffee from another country and then flying out to live there. So it was a bit odd. My parents were accepting of it. There was no real qualms about it, because, I mean, what, I was like 21, 20, 21.
Oh, fair enough. Though. That's not too bad then, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I kind of like, you know, just go do what you want, you know. And yeah, it worked out.
The funny thing is, like I said, to anyone who's a StarCraft 2 fan, they in their brain will think you're a veteran. They'll probably in your brain even do that thing where they just think you were there from the beginning. But actually, it was a couple of years in before you really got going. In fact, I'm sure by the time you joined, you maybe even had that fear a lot of people have of like, I missed it. Like, I joined at the end when it was like, you know, we were coming to like Heart of the Swarm, and how much longer is the game going to last, and League of Legends is taking off. What were you doing for the first year or two? Like, when, because if you remember, StarCraft 2 for the first like 2 years was like the number one game, and it was going so huge, yeah. And people were wondering how long is this going to last. Is it a few years, the big game? What was happening those first couple of years? Were you following the scene? Were you on the outside looking in? What was going on?
Yeah, so as soon as the StarCraft 2 beta was announced and stuff like that, I was, again, living in Finland, no job, no nothing, language barrier was difficult. I was like, okay, well, what can I do? And I thought to myself, I was wanting initially to go pro. That ended disastrously because I was nowhere near, like, I got to Masters, but I was nowhere near the guys, you know what I mean? So I was like, I was watching people like HD and Husky and Day9 and those guys at the beginning, and I thought to myself, I can do this. I'm pretty sure I can make a job out of this, almost to a delusional level, you know?
All right. You sort of need that in a way, though, to start, though, don't you, you know?
Yeah, I kind of think so. I mean, I look back at my original videos, and I think to myself, it's pretty bad, but you know what, there was some glimmers there where I had a bit of more of a posher accent and I could talk a bit of what I'm reverend. I mean, I'm from the north, so I don't really sound like a typical northerner, as you
sure
would agree, probably. It does slip in though sometimes when I'm speaking to northerners. But the for the first 2 years, especially the beta, I was just kind of playing, doing my own YouTube videos, commentating and things like that. And I was doing some online tournaments here and there and everything like that. But I just eventually thought to myself, as if I, you know, got to know the right people, put myself in front of the right eyes and things like that, and I would be able to eventually make it and make this work. And it did work out that way. I mean, the people that I really credit my success to in those early years, and it's funny because I had this conversation whilst I was in EWC with Rotterdam, was initially Mr. Bitter.
Oh, sure.
One of the people that I credit, because I eventually got to do an Asus ROG, like, very early on, because I'd done smaller Finnish tournaments. I was in Finland. I offered my services to the people that made these tournaments and also Asus ROG. Taking my PC on a bus through the snow in the middle of winter in Finland, it was rough, but you get yourself in front of these people, right? So I get to Asus ROG, I get to cast with Mr. Bitter, I get to cast with Rotterdam. Eventually, those two are moving away, because those two were full-time ESL commentators. They're moving away to NASL over in America, because they've been offered a big contract for that. And those two, I believe, I thought it was just Mr. Bitter, but then Rotty, literally last month, corrected me slightly, telling me that it was also him that had suggested, basically, to ESL, hey, you should take a look at this guy, because he's pretty good. So, yeah, that's how that worked out.
If people don't know, I actually had a similar scenario in Counter-Strike where there was once upon a time when I'd done some events with them, and they were like, do you want to come and live in Germany and basically be like a Counter-Strike commentator? And if people don't know, those gigs aren't like now where it's like you freelance, you work event. Eventually, you're an employee if you go and do that. And if you do it, it's like a pretty full-on gig. Like, as I alluded to, you might even end up not even working just in your own original game. They might have other things they're white labeling or other games they want to go, do you want to be our guy in this game? World of Tanks was a famous one back in the day. A lot of people had to do.
Yeah.
Right? When you do this sort of gig, Kalaris, it's also because it's like an employee position. They only tend to have a small cadre of people. They have, like you say, like three or four people or two or three people, and they invest in these people. It's one of the reasons why they promote them on the events and put them into other games. Were you someone where when you joined, was it going to be a full-on thing like this? Was it like temporary just StarCraft? Was it going to be like, I'm just part of ESL now?
So because StarCraft, as you mentioned, was actually so big in those first two, three formative years of the game, it was just StarCraft.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And for me, I was totally happy with that. That was kind of what I wanted to do. Admittedly, we weren't really being paid that much at all.
Fair enough.
In the grand scheme of things. I think when I joined, I was being paid like €2,200 a month. And I was,
which at the time I bet seemed amazing, but if you know anything about freelance rates, guys, that's nothing now, of course. Yeah,
precisely. I was like, a couple of days I'm making some money. This is sick. So it was just for StarCraft. I would come in and I was there for like the ESL weeklies that were going on, or go for SC2, back then. Sorry. I would do the German league that was going on, which eventually became the Meisterschaft and all this other stuff. I loved saying that word every single time. And be it the Intel Extreme Masters that come around. So actually, there was just so much StarCraft work going on that they never really pushed me towards other games. I think it took maybe 3 or 4 years before I entertained the idea of doing other games. And actually, that kind of had like knock-on effects, and I think made me a way better talent as a whole doing other games. But anyway, that's by the by.
Is it the case, like I alluded to before, when you first were the guy watching tournaments, but you're not a caster yet, did you ever have that wonder? Like, I'll give you a very brief tangent. In Counter-Strike, right, there was once upon a time three big duos. There was Henry G and Zadikis, there was Anders and Semler, and then the third one was DDK and Bardolf. And because they were not only the three big duos, but they sort of had, like, their territory scouted out, all the other commentators used to just whine and be like, we may as well just quit, like, you'll never ever displace them, they'll always be on top. And then the joke Calaris is, I think by like about 5-6 years ago, those duos all broke up, and actually anyone who'd been around with the wait for the opportunity would have not only had a chance to go to number one themselves, but they couldn't even have been part of one of those duos. And so the point of the analogy is, it's in the short term, it's very easy to look when someone's above you in the hierarchy and be like, no, well, I'll never be able to displace them, they'll always be above me, and you know, I'll always be the one on the outside looking in. Did you ever think in the early days, like, there was a lot of big commentators, streamers were obviously doing this gig, in fact a lot of players even were leaning into the idea, maybe I do some commentary. Did it ever look impenetrable to get to the top and to be the person doing the IEMs or the BlizzCons? Did it ever seem like it was up here and you were down here?
There's two parts to the answer. It's the first part is, it's actually the reason I branched out into other games. That is that exact reason. What is part of it, why I branched out into other games. Let's take a step back though from that reason for a second. And for the early years, I would say yes, definitely. Of course, you're in StarCraft and you've got Nick and Dan there, Tasteless and Artosis, right? Which is just like, that's an inassailable position for the majority of StarCraft commentators, even to this day, to be perfectly honest. Obviously, we just kind of finished up the EWC and Nick and Dan are on the finals again, right? Like, that's going to happen when they're there, guaranteed. Eventually, when we kind of kept going and stuff like that, and I was eventually with Apollo, obviously, like, we became the duo for Europe for a long, long, long time. And then Apollo kind of stepped away from a lot of commentary duties and did some desk hosting for a while. And then I was with Todd for a long time. We really got into the groove with those kinds of duos, and it was a lot of fun. So I felt like, I guess, once I'd started getting to Intel Extreme Masters regularly, basically being part of ESL, I kind of felt that was kind of breached a little bit. But as I said before, though, the reason I really started branching out is because I did feel maybe, 2014, 2015, end of 2015, something like that, that, okay, James, you are never going to, in just StarCraft, get to the position of Nick and Dan, Tasteless and Artosis. So what else is on the future? What's on the horizon? How can you make yourself better? How can you branch out and kind of make yourself a better talent across the board? And doing other games was kind of that avenue for me. So as much as it's a bit of a it's a bittersweet reason as to why you might want to branch out and stuff like that, but all there's other reasons, right? Like, I'm just an all-round gamer. I love loads of genres of games, and you know, there was that too. But part of it initially started out because I wanted to be better than other people.
Sure. By the way, totally human, obviously natural thing to want to do. What I would ask is this. In the early days, around the time we're talking about, actually, was also when there was less of like a sports, like specialist approach to commentary. Back then, you would absolutely sometimes have commentary duos that were just two play-by-play guys. And then, you know, one of them just knows enough about like the player histories to do a bit of what you call the color now. There wasn't necessarily a stricter division. And also, actually, this is the era when things like analysts and color commentators were pretty much being invented as a position, like a full-time thing where that guy just watched all the games, he knows all the Korean people, etc. Right? When you came into the industry, were you someone who was just thinking, like, I'm just going to be a commentator? Were you trying to, like, craft a brand of, like, what was your specialty? What was Kalaris's, like, angle? Did you try and think of this early on?
So, obviously, I wanted to start out and just wanted to be a commentator. And it's weird because even when I became, like, a lot more of a desk host role for a lot of other stuff, I still kind of just wanted to be a commentator. I kind of just fell into desk hosting by accident. And everyone was like, oh, you're really good at that. You should keep doing that. I was like, okay. So a lot of it was just the angle of, I just want to be a commentator. I like being enthused in the games. I liked being part of the games and being able to kind of show my excitement towards the games. So that was the initial outlook for everything like that. I never anticipated other roles, but of course, one thing that was good about StarCraft in the early years when you were commentating was you wouldn't just be on the commentary desk. You'd also end up flipping over to the analysis desk, like, you know, going over there and doing some talking alongside a desk host as well. And also, I think my commentary style back then lent itself really well to kind of like being malleable into other roles, because a lot of the times I'd be put next to an Apollo or somebody like that, and sometimes my play-by-play commentary would breach into asking questions about the game, like how can he approach this angle? Because one nice trick of commentary is literally just, if you want to make something sound like a conversation but it's not really a conversation, just ask a question, and that makes it instantly sound like a conversation straight away. If it's kind of genuine or not. Do you know what I mean?
By the way, along those lines, one thing I've always found quite weird about esports is a lot of fans, if you notice, their critique of commentators, actually, they don't obviously understand the field of commentary and what the techniques are. So all they tend to be critiquing is either one, do I like you or not? Or two, some vague idea of what game knowledge you have. And so many people in the industry are haunted by the idea like they're a fraud and they're not enough of an expert. Have you ever been a guy who ever bought into that? Did you wonder, like in your role, I would, like you just said, if you're next to Apollo, mate, I don't need you to know everything about StarCraft. He stood next to you. As long as you do a good job, but you say you get into the game and you throw it in for the right. I don't have an issue with that. So have you ever gotten into that angle? Have you ever felt like people made you feel like an imposter?
I never felt like an imposter, but in the early years of StarCraft, the fan base was very critical of especially play-by-play commentators, I would say.
Yes. I remember Total Biscuit used to get this a lot. I know now he's revered, but a lot of people back then were very cynical about his style. Yeah.
So if you were just a play-by-play guy, but you know the game, right? You know all the units. You know how these builds are going to kind of play out and stuff like that. You don't suddenly have to be this beacon of knowledge, as you say, when you've got someone like Apollo next to you. So your job is really to be enthused in the game, bring excitement almost to what's going on, or at least add to the excitement that is going on. So I never felt like an imposter, but there was a lot of people that were very critical of play-by-play guys back then. And I think as the years have gone on, it's funny because I go on the StarCraft Reddit every single day, right? And just still reading. And I'll do one series of commentary, like at last year's Gamers 8, there was the Legends tournament. So there was MC versus Stefano in the final. Nice. And they were like, hey, well, you know, it'd be cool if we got Kalaris on and he cast this game alongside Ben, Dimu. So I did. And lo and behold, I mean, even through the years when I've not been commentating, all of a sudden you get all these comments being like, oh, I've missed Kalaris casting. Oh, right. It's so good. Like, it's funny because I still get to do commentary in some of my other games.
Sure.
So it's not like I'm falling out of like the reps. It's not like, and I've also, even whilst just desk hosting, thought a lot about how I would approach commentary again, you know, how I would phrase things, when I would build up excitement, how I would build up to a certain moment. Every game's got their own different flow, of course. But yeah, so now it's I feel like all of a sudden there was this in the last 6-7 years there's the turn of like, oh, you know, we miss that guy, we miss player by player a lot more. But in the early years, now there was it was, I would say, 50-50.
Okay. As you mentioned yourself, obviously a role you became quite famous for too was the desk. One of the things, I mean, you've identified it yourself, I actually think is a massive positive you have, is you actually, considering the UK is just full of regional accents, you actually have, like, you've done what, it took me like 15 years to get there, but you did it in a few years. You've already polished the harsh edges off the accent. Like, it took me a long time before people didn't know, like they used to think I just sound like a Geordie before, basically. You know? And you can imagine back then, the joke would be, even the broken English person would be saying to me, excuse me, and they, it was me who had to repeat myself. Whereas I noticed eventually when they stopped saying that and they know what you're saying, like, you've sort of done it, right? Are you so, to me, one of your things was always like a professional sheen. Like, if you remember the era we're talking about, 2012 onwards, people actually, I mean, this is when my mate Too Good was still on desks. People were very unprofessional actually back then, almost as a gimmick of sort of like, hey, fuck, you know, the suit and tie thing. We're gamers and, you know, we're just like, we're a bit raw. I always thought you tried to bring a professionalism and you were wearing the suits when you could and stuff. Is this something you did consciously?
Did I do it consciously? Not so much. I mean, the thing about my accent is, even from a young age, so I grew up in North Yorkshire, and as you're fully aware, a lot of people don't sound like this in North Yorkshire. So my dad, for my entire childhood, would correct my English. We lived in a very small village, kind of, you know, very quaint place or whatever. And so I would say things like computer, but he would say, what did you say? And I'd say computer, sorry. Right. You know, just constantly like correcting my T's and things like that. And as much as it was annoying when I was a kid, obviously nowadays I am very grateful for that.
Dividends though. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Very like clear enunciation, clear accent, and hoping that I can translate that to, you know, many audiences, be they English speakers or not, depending on where they're from. As for the professionalism angle, I think that maybe in my formative years, I think maybe I was almost like too professional, a little bit of a stick, like just a bit too rigid and not willing to kind of flex. And you know, I wasn't able to impart a lot of like me, like you know, like flex my personality a bit more on shows and things like that. So I'd be wearing the suit, I'd be wearing the shirt, and you know, a tie if that stuff kind of came along and things. But I don't like that stuff,
right?
You know, I'd much rather not be wearing it personally. And in the last couple of years, thankfully, we've kind of gotten away with not having to do that. But I think one thing that really switched for me was like maybe 4 or 5 years into doing this. It was just kind of like just go with the flow on a lot of things. Just be jovial, have fun with it, roll with the punches, and don't be super professional. Of course, you can still present in a very professional way, but still have fun with it. But I kind of know what you're saying in that it was a professional pitch. It was a professional outlook that I kind of gave, and maybe it was a little too much sometimes.
Along that line, actually, the idea of how people criticize, because you're right, it was mainly player-by-player who got all the like criticism. Because as I say, it was sort of like, if people were being honest, if you could give them like truth serum and they had to just say what they actually thought, not critique, they'd have just said something like, I think I know more than you about StarCraft 2, so why do you get to be on the broadcast? It was almost like the weird vibe, even though, again, we're talking about a different role than the color commentator. Like, actually, we need these people to round out the broadcast. In fact, as you even said, what to a pleb might sound like, he doesn't even know what he's talking about. That question's intentional to get a really super smart person to give their take on it.
Yeah,
like it's a clever technique to make them give their next thought without being able to press a button and make them say it. So what I would ask is this. I remember a famous type of critique back then was, it was the idea that a lot of play-by-players were too addicted to hype casting. Like famously, the one that everyone used to hate if they were hardcore was, if you do the sort of thing like, they've got to hold the base, but it's like, you know, there's no supply left in the army and actually they're not going to, like the game's inevitably going to end. By the way, it's the same problem in League of Legends to this day. You have to sort of cast, like, and the next is about to blow up, but at that point the team's probably about to win anyway, right? You're not going to turn the whole game. So I would ask is this, is like, back then I always myself was torn, because on one level it's hard to not do any of that and to de-hype the game and be like, well, this game's basically almost over. So you are in a very tricky position. What would you say on that type of criticism? Like, is there a grain of truth to it? Were people not understanding the short element of it? What would you say?
I think some of my hypest moments in commentary back then were over extreme scenarios. If I'm thinking back to like Intel Extreme Masters Katowice's finals and things like that, right, where, you know, a lot is on the line, and that's right, why you're being super hype about certain things and stuff like that. Even though, like, you know, we know, commentators know, especially in those early years, we knew so much, like, okay, like, this game is over, guaranteed it's over and stuff like that. So you've got to skirt the fine line of when do you really call the GG?
Yes.
Like, when, because it... I understand.
There
is
no real good answer, is there? Because put it this way, when I have friends of mine who are like the super experts, the problem is, Klaus, they essentially can do the equivalent of you call the GG 5 minutes into the game, you know, like, but then that would ruin the whole game. You couldn't really go that far. So it is a pretty hard sort of like line to walk, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I think you don't get it in your first couple of years when you're commentating. Like, absolutely. I think that a lot of people in your first couple of years of commentating, you're really wanting to impress still. You're still wanting to impress. You're wanting to impress your bosses. Sure. Wow, look how hype he was as a player-by-player. You're wanting to impress some of the Redditors. Wow. Or maybe you're still in your honeymoon period with a community where they're like, whoa, he brings a certain energy to this game that, you know, that we've never seen before, even though they have seen before. But so there's a lot of factors to consider. I can't really answer your question, quite honestly. I was trying in those first couple of lines, but it's difficult because there's so many facets that I think you have to consider.
What was it in that, like, here's the thing, it's very easy when you get good over time to lose track of like how I leveled up and when it was I did exactly. If I asked you to cast your mind all the way back to that first BlizzCon, which was pretty early in your career, bro, you actually got to work that event like pretty early on. Like, what was it? If we were to look back now, I don't know if you've ever gone back, what would your style be like? Were you good back then? Were you already like hitting your stride, do you think?
That's a good question. Because For BlizzCon especially, I was quite salty about not being invited to my first BlizzCon. And I remember Wax Angel from Team Liquid sent me a bottle of whiskey because I was actually just so salty.
Okay.
Like, thanks, Wax. I appreciate that. But the BlizzCon, the first BlizzCon that I did work, I guess I felt like I'd... That was actually the goal. That was initially the goal, right? Because I was a big Blizzard fan for a long time. I'd played Warcraft 2, Warcraft 3... World of Warcraft for so many years. Like, literally without World of Warcraft, my career would not be like this, sure, right? Because I wouldn't have met that girl. I wouldn't have moved to Finland. Yeah. So Blizzard had a huge impact on my life. So to go to BlizzCon and work it, I felt like I truly made it. And for us in StarCraft, that really was the pinnacle. Sure. We're basically in a big arena at that point, or one of the big halls where you've got like thousands and thousands of fans. Do I think my commentary had hit its stride? Do I think it was good? I think if you showed me it now, I think I'd have an extreme list of criticisms to shake at it. But you're talking, what, 12 years ago now?
Yeah.
It's difficult to say. I think I was probably fine. I mean, I was stood next to the likes of Day 9 casting, Apollo casting. I think I probably cast something with Artosis as well. So I was next to some of the greats, really. In those years, I described my commentary style as not only kind of the play-by-play, but also the enabling style, right? Asking the questions, trying to get things out of them. I think it was okay for the time. Let's put it that way.
To touch on what we mentioned earlier, it's weird because there is like this bizarre double side to doing any on-camera work, which is like we said, on the one hand, even when you're not actually good, you have to sort of think that you're good or you have talent or you can be really good. But at the same time, if anyone looks back even more than 2 or 3 years, they're always going to think, oh, I was so bad back then. What the hell? Oh, this is way worse than I remember. What would you say to that? Like, when you started, have you always had like some unshakable sense of like, I either have talent or I can be the best or it's possible for me? Have you got some drive force like that in you?
Sorry, do you mean like what I would in terms of give criticism back to?
No, I mean, do you have like an inherent sense that you should have been really good back then, or like I actually have a talent where I could be the best caster, or I'm better than the people who are ahead of me, and like, do you have like an actual feeling like that pushing you forwards when you're a caster?
I didn't think I had the talent like naturally. I felt like at the time I had to work at it to try and get there, but I felt like I could work at it to get to where it was. And obviously I did because it was successful and it worked out and here I am now. But it's a tough question again.
Are you very self-critical thinking backwards? Are you able to go, that was just a time and the place? Or do you ever think like I wasn't good enough back then, or I've now got to a good level? How do you think of it when you look back now?
I think if I look back truly, I was not good enough then to justify the standards that I wanted, if you know what I mean. I think the way in which I was play by playing, I think sometimes I fell into those pitfalls again, because it was kind of the early years, right, of what you were suggesting, like, okay, maybe I was too hype in some moments. Maybe I didn't know exactly when to rein in. Maybe I didn't know when to add something, you know, more jokes and things like that. I think it does take a lot of years to try to get to where you really want it to be. I think now, if you ask me the same question, or do you think that you are where you should be, like in terms of desk hosting, absolutely. In terms of even when I get to be on an analysis desk for like PUBG Mobile, for example, yes, absolutely, because I know the game really well. And even in commentary now, when I get to commentate, because I get to commentate PUBG coming up in like a week or two. Don't know if this is time sensitive, sorry. But basically, yeah, I think like I'm at a position where I want to be now. But that took a lot of effing years to get to. So yeah, those early years, I definitely could have been better than I was. But it's so time sensitive. How often do you get a chance to commentate at a BlizzCon stage? Often do you get a chance to commentate on a Katowice stage to be able to fully put it into practice? There's only so much you can get out of commentating at home into a microphone, into a camera, online. So it's tough.
I mean, along those lines, to me as well, another thing that has changed in esports is, funnily enough, the era we're describing at the beginning of your career was also when esports actually as a whole had this weird hangover effect where they did think we're trying to be like sports. And so we're trying to professionalize. I'm doing air quotes for that, because that the reality is you were just copying another medium. And I will say, even though I would say that actually still exists somewhat in sports, if you watch like the Premier League or something, they're not going to be too jovial. I actually think, if anything, though, that's where esports has differentiated itself. If anything, aren't all the best duos that you think of in all the big games, they're actually masters at slipping into the informal and having jokes and having memes and bringing it. I think actually that's something essential to esports, right? So I can see why you've put such an emphasis on it in this interview. It's important to be able to like have that as well as the knowledge, right?
Yeah, I'm of the opinion that we are a lot, maybe I'm totally wrong, and I could be totally wrong, but I am of the opinion that in terms of entertainment value and entertainment factor, we are so much better than traditional broadcasters.
I think so, yeah.
Like on TV and stuff like that. As I say, I feel like there's just the emphasis on the professional, right? And I think that it's probably a generational thing, right? Like our parents, I mean, maybe they would entertain the idea of like these guys going a little bit off cuff and stuff like that. But you're honestly, like if you're thinking about a football match, they're live for what? The desk is live for what? 15 minutes before the game, half an hour on a thingy, and then 50 minutes afterwards. It's not the same as doing a StarCraft broadcast where suddenly you're alive for 10, 12 hours.
Sure.
So it's sort of difficult to compare. Maybe they could be able to swim in the environment and maybe they could be entertaining, but I think that esports broadcasters, especially the ones that are scrutinized most, maybe at the top, top games, or like I think we have great broadcasters in the games that I work in, like StarCraft for example. Could they swim there? I don't know.
Let me ask you about some of the people you worked with. So obviously one of the first names was Apollo. And once upon a time, he actually was being held up in the same sort of air as like the Artosis of the world, like the ultimate super mega brains that ever wants to hear talk. But as you said, around the time that you were actually commentating with him was when he was already 1 foot in the like ESL. Maybe I'm the producer guy. Maybe I'm behind the scenes. Mm. Maybe I'm working on the Now, I've always thought, by the way, that's actually one of the few downsides of the esports industry is you don't really get to be like John Motson and just be the commentator for 50 years in esports, because like you sort of hit the ceiling of the industry if you do that. It's not a gig that you can do forever, potentially. You have to do other things. Who was Apollo when you first came along? Was he already for you like at that status? What was it like to work with him? Must be interesting.
So in 2011, 2012, I can't remember when it was, but I remember going to an Asus ROG in Finland before I was eventually doing an Asus ROG. Maybe it was like 6 months after or something like that. And it was Apollo and Total Biscuit commentating. And I went there just to watch and things like that. And I was like, hey, you know, very nice to meet you guys, blah, blah, blah. I'm an aspiring commentator and all this stuff. I don't think Apollo at that time expected then suddenly to be working with me a year later.
Sure.
But yeah, no, I have sort of reverence for them. Especially it came to Sean very naturally to just sit there and just talk about the game and talk about the intricacies of the game. So it was a lot of fun working with Sean. We were two very different people, though. We were considered like the duo in Europe, right? But we were two very different people back then. You know, in Germany, in Cologne, he was the kind of guy that was like, okay, we get paid, they're going out, like all the people at ESL, they're going out, yeah. They're drinking, stuff like that. I was the kind of guy that just wanted to go home, play video games.
Oh, right.
Just, you know, save my money, basically. So there was definitely, we were, as I say, very different people. But when it came together on broadcasts, obviously, I think it worked tremendously. I mean, as the StarCraft community still seems to say, you know, they still seem to miss our duo. It's like, what, 10 years later or something ridiculous. So, yeah, it was nice. It was lovely working with Apollo.
And then along those lines, one of the pairings I actually always thought was funny, just because like it has all the cultural background, the totally different person, is you and Todd. Because to me, I actually know Todd a bit from the industry as well. And he actually is how he seems on camera, guys. He is a ridiculous guy, but he's also like, he can be a very funny and warm guy. And even though he's so harsh in some ways, he knows he's being harsh. He's sort of like actually quite self-aware. Who is Todd to you? He was an interesting pairing, I thought, with you.
Todd is... Yep, Todd's interesting. Yep. No, I love Johan. Well, I love him and I hate him at the same time, if I could say okay. That sometimes. Todd has butted heads with literally everybody at one time or another at some time. And also, I think a lot of people who he would consider very good friends have also maybe even been blocked by him on Twitter sometimes.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because Todd has a very strong sense of justice, an unbelievably strong sense of justice, and that can be very admirable in a lot of scenarios. And then sometimes maybe it, like, he'll be in a game, my desk is next to his, and I'll be trying to get past him to go to the bathroom at ESL, and I'll have accidentally slightly touched his chair, and he'll get very angry at me. You know what I mean? Like, because he's focusing on the game. He's okay. He's a pro gamer, right? Yeah. Like, he was Warcraft 3 champion and all this stuff. So, you know, the game means a lot to him. And these times mean a lot to Todd. So, but we had a great time commentating. We really fit each other very, very well. He also has a good sense of humor, I would say, when you really get him going. So me and him had some odd moments, like a famous one in StarCraft 2 is when we were doing WCS Poitiers in the middle of nowhere in France. And we'd been on for 12 hours. It was just, StarCraft broadcasts are still to this day so long compared to other games. And Hass was playing a player from Taiwan, and he's the most ridiculous player, and he was doing ridiculous tactics, and I just lost it. And I could not stop laughing on broadcast for like 45 minutes. And everyone was just coming in, and I got Todd going as well. I just mentally broke after like 12 hours. It was
like you suddenly had gone.
Yeah, I was gone. Right. I was gone. And I remember experiencing this with Todd, and Todd just like, it was, casting with Todd was awesome back then. I haven't seen him in so long. He recently turned up to a home story cup, but I was not able to go. So, yeah.
And then similarly, I always thought you actually paired quite well with Rotterdam as well, because I mean, he can do both. He can be the entertainer, but he can also be like the boffin too. Seems like you always vibed with him.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Roddy, I literally still talk to him almost every other day, to be perfectly honest, be it him streaming and me just hanging out with him or whatever. We were just together over for EWC as well. And currently, because we're in the off season for StarCraft, we're kind of like joint funding some Monday tournaments that are replacements for the ESL weeklies, because we just kind of want to keep things going for pro game. We're literally, actually, it's happening right now, is our Kalaris Steadfast and Rotty Cup 2. It's happening right now. So I'm basically just funding prize pool because I want to be able to give back to the scene a little bit, considering we're 14 years deep now in this game. I know that might not be much to you, considering you're a CS guy. You're pretty deep, but 14 years is pretty
admirable. That's still good. That's good. Anything over 10 is very good for esports, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And by the way, you've got to give me, everyone who I ever ask about Rotterdam, you have to give me a Rotterdam story, because the thing is, if people don't know as well, that's also totally true. He is actually the ridiculous person he appears on camera. Like, I'll give you an example of my own. I remember one time being at an event where I was working with the ESL in Counter-Strike, and he was doing like Warcraft 3 at the end before Starcraft came out. Although, by the way, this is actually when the Starcraft beta came out. So already I can tell you a ridiculous Rotterdam side story, which is even though he's there working Warcraft 3, because the Starcraft 2 beta's out, every second he's not on camera, he's playing Starcraft 2 beta. Even though it's like, but maybe wait till after the event. You have to understand Rotterdam. He's like, if he's into it, he's into it. And then secondly, I realized, right, he doesn't just like go in the world and encounter weird scenarios. He creates them. Like, he would come and he would go like, right, guys, which one of you dares me to eat these two massive German kebabs for a bet? And I was like, none of us. Like, why would we? Like, I'm not even that sort of person for the UK, man. I'm not really like a practical joke. Like, why would anyone want that? But he was like insistent that one of us had to bet him that he was going to eat these giant kebabs. And then he did it. And I was like, what even was this? Like, are you like Kramer or something? What is it? You're just some weird character that's just entered the scene. So if people don't know, he's not just like a fun character on camera. He really is like this in real life, right? He's kind of a ridiculous. He's also the guy where back then, like, it's not even that he's trying, guys. He would just by default talk to every woman that passed him in the street. You know what I mean? Or anyone waiting at a bus stop or in a fucking, again, in a kebab shop. Like, he's just a guy automatically. He's the most social person you probably ever meet, right? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, he'll get on with
it. Give me a Rotterdam story, come on.
I couldn't think of anything for off the back, and then it suddenly just dawned on me. It's very odd and very minor, but it's very Rotterdam. So we were doing, I was commentating a series recently at a StarCraft event, a very rare thing that happens or whatever, but occasionally they'll have me on and just do one or two. Anyway, when that happens, usually what will occur is Rotty will say, I could desk host, mate. And I'm like, oh, yeah, sure, no problem. So he goes and does the desk hosting. Anyway, I come back to the desk after he's done. I've done the cast. Everyone's liking it. That he's done the desk hosting. Everyone's loving it. And I come back to the desk, and we've got like little laptops. And all of a sudden, in the search bar of the internet browser, there is like things like Reyna 2-1 against Oliveira, blah 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 in the search bar in the search bar, and I'm like, what is all this? It was all along the search bar. I'm like, what is this? And I'm like, and it dawns on me suddenly, he's taken the notes for his desk segment that he wants to put in the search bar of the internet browser. I'm like, why have you put it here of all places? You could have opened a notepad, anything, but no, apparently in the search bar. And I asked him afterwards, he's like, that's just what I do. I'm like, why? Okay. So, yeah, that's a small anecdote, I suppose.
By the way, in light of what you said earlier, the other thing I always thought was actually quite cool about this early StarCraft 2 days is, unlike actually all the other games where it has separated into, like, this is a duo of person A and person B, and they always get hired as a package. Back then, you had all those events where they mixed it up still. So, for example, if people don't know, you've casted games with Art Horses, etc. You've been thrown in the mix. By the way, if you're someone coming from the outside and StarCraft exists and you want to get into the scene, and like you say, you're a fan of Blizzard games, even to just do a game with Art Horses must be mad. That's got to be a surreal moment, right?
Yeah, some of the first tournaments that I did and I was casting with Dan were a little bit weird, right? Because as you say, like, if I go back to my Finland days, I'm watching MLGs late at night or whatever, there's Nick, there's Dan, there's Sean, kind of all casting, the Roddy and Mr. Bitter and all these guys. Obviously, as a StarCraft fan, you'd be remiss if you weren't kind of an avid viewer of the GSL. So, of course, Nick and Dan hold this certain kind of, again, lofty position from way back then. Obviously, now that's not the case anymore in terms of, like, it's just Nick that's out there commentating it. But I think maybe the first time I cast with Artosis was Intel Extreme Masters Singapore. And I was, you know, nerding out a little bit over the idea of casting with Dan. But I think actually me and him as a duo always really, really worked. I mean, even in my early days, like, because again, I was happy to just be the player-by-play and be the enabler. And this is when Dan was really on the ball when it came to StarCraft 2 knowledge. And, you know, it just worked really well. So, yeah, it was fun casting with Dan. I mean, it was fun casting with Nick as well. Obviously, just a very different style, because technically Nick is very much so the storyteller, the player-by-player guy and stuff like that. It was very rare we got to cast together, because obviously our styles were very similar way back then. But that was always fun too. And now, you know, obviously when it comes to some StarCraft events, we get to have them there, and whenever we get to have them on the desk or whatever, we have a good time. So,
Were you one of the people, I mean, you said because of the Blizzard game angle, you had like the reverence for BlizzCon. That is kind of like a big deal again to get to go down the career check mark. Was Korea a big deal for you? Were you someone who actually also had like the interest in Korea? Did you have the draw to go there?
I really wanted to go there. I thought I was going to go there.
Right.
Not a lot of people, I've never really said this publicly, so let's do it. I was told by a certain somebody when I was in, again, my first year or two of commentary, and then they realized that I was getting pretty decent and stuff like that. I thought I was going to get to go over and cast Code A, which was, you know, the Code A and Code S. Obviously, Nick and Dan did Code S. And eventually it became Kaldor and Wolf that casted yes. Code A.
Yes.
And then also Doa was over there for a while as well, if I recall. I thought I was going to cast Code A, and I was buzzing for the idea. I was like, okay, well, you know, I'm ready. I'm good for the idea of going out there, living in Korea, casting Code A, because at that time there was nothing. There was no shackles, right? There was no, like, I'm a young guy.
You live wherever you want.
Yeah, do whatever you want. So I'll just go there and cast Code A. So I was told that I was going to get the opportunity to do this. I was like, oh, this is great. This person's going to put my name forwards and I'm going to be able to do it. Never heard back from them. So I think, yes, absolutely. I was interested in casting out in Korea. And who knows how my career would have gone trajectory-wise if I'd have gone out there. I do think maybe it would have been harder because Europe afforded me a lot of possibilities and a lot of potential. Being with ESL and kind of having a lot of tournaments, kind of just actually being with ESL in general, I think afforded me a lot of opportunities.
Sure.
so maybe it would have been harder if I'd have gone out to Korea. But I will always be a little bit salty about the fact that I was told that, hey, you're probably going to get a chance to come out to Korea. And I was very buzzing for it. And maybe I was a bit naive in my young age.
I use someone where it's so many years back in StarCraft, I feel like we can all finally have a sane conversation about what Wings of Liberty was like in that last year, where it was just every Zerg player shitting on everyone else with Broodlord and Fester, etc. Right? Yeah. Look, at the time, we all had to do that thing of like, is it too far? We need to. It was almost like politics. We need to have serious questions and inquiries made about what's going on with the patch. But no one could just come out because we're all working in the industry and go, this is broken. What's Blizzard doing? Right?
Mm.
Now that we had all the other versions of StarCraft and we got plenty of healthy cycles of the metas and all different units and races got their chance to be on top. What do you think of that era when it was like, in theory, all the patch circs were winning? Do you think it went too far? Was it a bit homogenous, the results? Were you vibing with it? What were you like back then? What do you think?
Yeah, I like how you phrase it, because I feel like now when you're this far in, when you're 14, 15 years in, you just don't really have a filter. We can say. I even tweet out about a lot of PUBG tournaments that I'm unhappy with, right? But I'm literally the desk host of the world championship, all this other stuff. I feel like, you know, I've commanded enough respect to be able to just speak my mind now after all this stuff. But anyway, that's a complete tangent in itself. Yes, obviously, like the some of the last tournaments, the Zergs being the way they were, was genuinely a problem. It didn't do any us any favors in terms of the viewability of the game, the viewership of the game. It's not just the rise of League of Legends that hurt us, I would say, in those early years. It was also kind of the meta and the way it did sit. I think that Heart of the Swarm with Swarm Host did more damage to us than Broodlord Infestor.
Right.
On the transition to from Wings of Liberty to Heart of the Swarm, we did a Heart of the Swarm beta tournament at one of the Intel Extreme Masters. I think it was before the World Championship moved from CBIT to Katowice.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So we did a beta tournament for Heart of the Swarm, and I was asked by Carmack, hey, okay, so we're going to have David Kim there, who was the balance designer of StarCraft at the time. We're going to ask him for an interview, and we need you to come up with the questions. I was like, okay, cool, that sounds great. Anyway, one of my questions was, are you concerned about the Swarm Host and how it might impact the game with free units? Because obviously we just come off the back of the Broodlord Infestor era, where it was scary, right? Anyway, that question was vetoed. I was not allowed to ask that question. And I was very disappointed, because we could see the writing on the wall of what the Swarm Host was going to do, and we ended up in situations where some games went on for 2 hours.
Yeah, the delay was the worst part. Yeah,
yeah, it was insane. It was especially in Europe, where me and Apollo are casting WCS Europe, and so many of the Zergs were strong there, and they realized, hey, we can just do this stalemate the game out, and then eventually win via attrition. So I was disappointed that that was vetoed, because I felt like a lot of us saw what was coming, and I think it did have an actual hurtful impact on StarCraft II and its popularity, even though we have diehard fans, and obviously it's still quite popular, not relative to the huge games, but you know what I mean.
By the way, along those lines, since you reference it, another thing that happened in your career as well was you transitioned from the era when the big events were just at actually the trade shows. It was Gamescom, it was CeBIT in Hanover. Like, that's actually where you'd have it. And obviously you'd have all the like noise, and you'd have maybe one hall, to the eras when esports gets its own venue. It gets a bit like WCS is in its own place, it's in its own final spot. Obviously the Blizzard circuit all work together to go to BlizzCon for the finals, right? Do you actually look back? I don't know if you do those gigs anymore nowadays in PUBG or whatever, but like, do you still have fun memories of CeBIT and Gamescom? Are you able to put all the annoying parts out?
So I guess the closest thing that comes to us doing that is stuff like the DreamHacks right now, like for example, DreamHack Dallas or DreamHack Atlanta that's just happened for us. So we still have other booths going on around us sometimes, and some of them are allowed and some are not. I do not miss the XMG booths. Or those booths around us that were just pumping music.
Oh, they were
so
very loud.
Loud
as well, wouldn't it? Yeah.
And the problem would be just, you know, that these booths, they'd be loud, and then we'd turn our booths up, and then they'd turn their booth
right.
up, and then it was just this never-ending right. battle. You know what I mean? It's just, oh, God. I genuinely think eventually, I mean, I already damaged my hearing because of drumming, but those trade shows probably significantly impaired
sure.
me even more. All things considered, but I do have a slight fondness for them. CeBIT was in Hanover, right? And the weird thing about CeBIT in Hanover was there was no hotels, so you'd have
to
stay in
it. Yeah.
Random people's houses.
Yep. I've literally stayed when I was a journalist and I worked with ESL as well. I once had to stay in like the attic of like some German couple who like had no children. I was like, what even is this? Like, I can barely talk to them. It's weird, isn't it? It's just weird, mate.
Yeah, the one that really comes to mind was I had an ex-girlfriend that we went to CeBIT and we were at Hanover or whatever, and she was coming along because she was also doing some photography at the venue as well. And then we get given this random house for this random German couple. We get into our room, there's a cross on the wall, there's two single beds, and they're like, there'll be no funny business. Okay. And I'm like, we're adults, what is this?
I know.
Like, this is ridiculous. Oh, dear me.
True. That is what it was like back then. It's true. If people don't know. Yeah. Right, well, actually, here's my question. And similar to the Pat Zerg one, you can now tell me, right? At the time, the idea that wasn't even allowed to be processed was, is region locking good or bad? Because it was WCS. Like, that would be like saying, do you want to work as a commentator or not, Kalaris? It's like, if you do, you better get on board with this whole region locking thing. It's what we're doing. What do you actually think of that now? Like, what were the pros and cons when you look back now? Because I'm sure there were some aspects that people liked about it. There's some parts people didn't like. Obviously, we don't really do it as much now. What did you think of the whole, like, region locking WCS era?
So I actually think that I got in trouble for my opinion back then. In an interview, because now you can't find that interview anymore because it was on acer.esports.com or something. But I think I got in trouble for my opinion on region locking. And I think it's one of the reasons why I didn't get invited to that BlizzCon I was telling you about earlier. So basically, I came out and said that I like the idea of the region lock. This was at the time when MVP, MC, and MMA and all these guys were playing in WCS Europe and stuff like that. And I liked the idea of region lock. I like the idea that you have each region playing into each other to figure out who is then eventually going to be able to go and play, you know, just kind of tee it up and up and up. I mean, there's so many arguments for and against, right? Like, for example, MVP and MC and MMA, if they are technically playing in our region, do they then level up all the competition if they're able to play on the ladder?
Right.
There's so many facets to this. So I was for region lock in the sense that if people came and played on our server and lived in our region, then you are part of the region lock. Does that make sense? Because then you're kind of contributing to that region, contributing to that scene. And eventually hopefully leveling up the rest of the scene. There were a lot of instances in region lock where America was a terrible example, where suddenly you'd have Koreans just coming along and playing for a week and then buggering off back to Korea.
Yes.
And really not contributing anything to that region as a whole. So I don't mind that idea of region lock, where people have to contribute effectively to the scene.
What do you think about, like, the famous meme was always in StarCraft, like, StarCraft's a dead game? Because what they really meant was it didn't have the heights of League of Legends. I always tell people, by the way, no game did. I come from Counter-Strike, which is a huge game. And guess what? We don't have, like, China and Korea. So we don't have an enormous global game like League of Legends did. As far as I can tell, League of Legends is the only game that's ever actually truly conquered the whole world, right? So the thing I always have to tell modern-day esports fans is, some of them even still say that to me, Klaus. Like, you remember StarCraft 2? I'm like, what do you mean remember? It's still going and it never died. Like, yeah. It's actually always, it's been going the whole time. And if you ever look up, what'll actually blow your mind, if you're a fan from the old school watching this interview for nostalgia reasons, look up on esports earnings, the players who've won the most money. Some of the names will blow your fucking mind. Like, basically, like, you know, Major, they'll play from South. He's won like loads, by the way. But in your brain, you're thinking he's just some guy from way back in the day. Like, there were so many tournaments after the golden age. So, like, one thing I would ask you is this. Obviously, you've done other games as well, right? Mm. Do you think StarCraft, as it is now, in theory, this game could just go forever, right? It really could. If it's got the legs to keep going now, it could just go another 10 years, right?
Yeah, especially with the way the community is. Obviously, like, we live in this limbo currently. You actually hit this interview at a good time, because we're in this situation where at the end of every single year at the moment, we don't know what's going to happen in terms of support, because Blizzard's pretty hands-off. They've kind of basically given the reins to ESL. And ESL, thankfully, has quite a few people inside who is like, okay, well, we do like StarCraft. And obviously, it provides unbelievable levels of competition.
Yes.
Especially with the way the games were at EWC, it was insane. But we live in this world where we just don't know what's going to happen next for our game. I would like to think, because of the level of competition that we do have, and honestly, is esports without one big RTS title truly at the top? I would say, personally, no. I'm a little bit biased, of course. Even if we don't know in this kind of current month or two period as to what's going to happen, I imagine an announcement will come out relatively soon-ish, in theory. The community around it will keep supporting. Like, so whilst the season's going on, we have our weekly cups going on. However, literally now we don't have those weekly cups going on. So what's currently going on, like, for example, in Europe is me, Steadfast, and Roddy are contributing to prize pool to do one. There is two people over in America that are contributing prize pool to keep the Korean one going. There is Wardy and OSC that are contributing prize pool to keep the America one going. So suddenly the community has rallied around to kind of provide those weekly, which adds up to, what, $1,200? Never mind the idea of bigger tournaments that are coming along. You know, like a $10,000 tournament just happened in Bulgaria, in Strava Zagora, literally yesterday, just wrapped up yesterday. So there is still an unbelievably hardcore community that will just keep it going forever, basically. And it's a shame that Blizzard, I would say, basically abandoned the scenario that is StarCraft 2, because for my money, it's their most legitimate esport.
Yeah.
You could make your argument for StarCraft 1, of course, but that's a very Korean-based thing.
Sure.
it's their most legitimate esport by far. It trumps Overwatch, absolutely. It trumps Hearthstone, trumps all this other stuff, even though I like World of Warcraft MDI and stuff like that. But there's nothing quite like StarCraft 2. And will there always be an RTS? Yes, probably. Will it be the upcoming RTSs? Stormgate's having a rough time, of course. Battle Aces on the horizon looks exciting, but it's not an RTS in the same vein. It's not a base-building RTS with that kind of pacing. So, yeah, I hope RTS continues well.
Along those lines, another thing I know people sometimes struggle with when their talent is, actually, is it the game that I love? Do I just love being like a famous commentator? Do I love working in the industry? Do I like, you know, the idea that my game has to be big and it has to be on the BlizzCon stage? You know, there's other aspects to it as well. Does the fact that you still interact with StarCraft, does this imply you inherently just love StarCraft the game? Like, it sustains you in some way?
Would I be here 14 years later if it didn't? It's funny because I go to these tournaments and oftentimes you will get that. I'll get that question. I've had it multiple times and I say the same thing. Would I be here 14 years later if I didn't? Do I need StarCraft 2? No, technically not with the other games that I currently do in terms of financing myself in a stable lifestyle. Technically, no. But just love the game. There's nothing like RTS really on the market. I love my I watch so many esports. I watch a little bit of CS, but it's not really my thing. I don't really watch Valorant. I watch Dota 2 aside from my games like PUBG, PUBG Mobile. I watch so much, but there's nothing quite like StarCraft 2. And I think, yeah, I the reason I do the games that I do is because I love the games that I do. I kind of got lucky with PUBG because of a sudden PUBG Mobile came along, and it's basically the same game with just a little bit of a difference in render distance, some like gun differences and things like that. So basically for a long time I got to, two games for the price of one, which was really nice. But actually way back, maybe like 2016, Richard Lewis of all people said to me, why don't you do Counter-Strike? Why don't you do Dota? Why don't you do these bigger games? You could be bigger, you know, like you could be a bigger talent. It's like, well, probably. Yeah, I probably could. But there's two things to that. One, I just want to do the games that I love, which is a very fortunate position to be in. Sure. Let's be real. But two, also, I want to be knowledgeable about the games that I do, especially in a desk host capacity, because one thing I really don't like at the moment in esports is the generic desk host. The desk host that just comes along and says, well, I'm asking these questions because a noob would ask these questions. And no, that's bollocks. That's just lazy. You don't have a good work ethic for the games that you want to do. And I also don't like a lot of people that use games like I do, which I think are underappreciated, like a StarCraft, which is kind of like completely barred off. But like a PUBG or a PUBG Mobile, I don't like talent coming in that just want to use it as a stepping stone to get to a CS and stuff like that. And I see this way too much, and it infuriates me because I love these games. And I want these games to succeed well. You're just using it as a means to an end for you. You know what I mean?
Yes.
This got a little bit...
No, no, I know exactly what you mean. Like, put it this way. I won't say names, but I know people right now who actually look like talents to people in certain other games. But if you ask them, they're like, oh, I'd leave tomorrow if I could go do CS, or I actually really want to be in Dota instead of this. And the way it does come across on camera, I can tell you if you've been in the industry, is like you say, one, I either want the person who's my host or my play-by-play to be really, like, they love the game. I want that to sleep off the screen. But then secondly, like you say, yes, there's going to be some questions you ask, like, as like a method to allow the other person to be smart. But in a dream world, like in StarCraft, since you love the game anyway, it's more, it should be more that's why you're asking the question. You also want to know yourself some really interesting detail. It can't be a pure noob question, like you say. Like, you can tell who doesn't do the research, right? The people who do, they're actually going to, even if they are beginners, like, you can't fake the authenticity, right?
Yeah, and I think a lot of people don't see, a lot of the viewership and the viewers don't see what happens behind closed curtains. Like, you'll have... I'm not throwing any names under the bus, but I know people who may watch this interview might even know who they are. Who knows? But you'll be doing a desk, or you'll be, you know, be doing a tournament and stuff like that. You'll finish a desk segment or whatever, and the game will be playing. And instead of watching the game and thinking about what we're going to say on the desk, they'll be sat there
on Twitter, everything. Yeah, I'll watch it. Yeah.
Are you not like watching the game? Yeah. When I'm at a StarCraft event, and every single talent will back this up, it's funny because we had a funny tweet like a year ago saying, huh, Kolaris is here again. Why is he here? He doesn't even care about the game. And every single talent came out and was like, you do realize Kolaris is like the one in the back who just watches every game religiously. Like, just because, I mean, that's what you should be doing.
Yeah, that's what you're there for. Yeah.
Yeah. You're being paid a pretty decent amount, to be perfectly frank, for doing this job. And you should sure as hell do a good job of it when it comes to being on the desk, talking about the game, talking about what's relevant.
Everyone needs a support network. And mine is, of course, my Patreon community, the Scrumanati, who in many ways, they're the Sonny to my share, saying, I got you, babe. So this video and all the others on my channel were kindly supported by the following names: Ahmed Haju, Mac Pugnaccio Rakula, Adam Tomlin, Animosity, Jensen Gore, Tosh, Toucan, and you know it, Jerky's Minion, my main man, always going to be referenced, one of the best patrons of all time. Would you like to ask a question in my AMA? Maybe you want to suggest a topic or a guest to see on my channel. Do you want teasers? Find out who the upcoming Reflections and Talk to Thor interviews are. Maybe you want to do one of those long discussions where you get to set the topics we talk about. Well, if any of these or others appeal to you, put your money where your mouth is. Join the Scrumanati today via the Patreon link in the description box below.